All of us writers know that the term famous poet is a contradiction. If you're going to be a poet, you're probably not going to be famous. Billy Collins is one of the only exceptions to that. He is the most famous poet in America whose name is not Maya Angelou. And we're very happy to have him on the show today. He is the author of many, many books. I'll name a few. Ballistics, She Was Just 17, The Trouble with Poetry, Nine Horses, Sailing Around the Room, Picnic Lightning, The Art of Drowning, The Apple That Astonished Paris. I love that title. And he was a former U.S. Poet Laureate, winner of many, many, many prizes, including the National Endowment for the Arts, the Guggenheim Foundation. He is also one of the very few poets who has bestsellers. His poetry books are actually bestsellers, believe it or not. His latest book is called Horoscopes for the Dead, and we're very pleased to have a famous poet on Words on a Wire, Billy Collins. Guernica magazine said, and they meant this in the nicest way, that Billy Collins is the class clown in the schoolhouse for American poetry. And I have to say, you are one of the funniest poets I've ever read. Right now I'm reading Horoscopes for the Dead, and can you tell us a little bit about that book, where it came from, how long it took you to write it? And
well, class clown sounds a little demeaning, but yeah, if I was allowed to make a substitution, someone once introducing me before a reading said that Billy Collins puts the fun back in profundity. So
that one is much better, yes.
That one, right. Well, as far as the book goes, I mean, when I'm writing poems, I think like most poets or many of them, I'm just working on the poem. I'm really not thinking about the audience for the poem. I'm not thinking about the book it's going to be in. It takes enough concentration just to work line by line and follow the progress of a poem. So, you know, every few years when I feel like enough decent poems or better than decent have accumulated, it just occurs to me it could be book time. And if it is, I just take the best ones and assemble them. So there's always these obsessive themes in any poet's book. And I suppose mine are mortality and my place in that scheme. And, you know, those themes come up again and again. So usually my temperament leads me in a direction where I'm kind of mixing mortality and humor. So, you know, for example, the poem Horoscopes for the Dead, I mean, the title itself is a little kind of strangely optimistic to attribute a future to the deceased. But, you know, that came about when, after a friend of mine died a few years ago, I don't read horoscopes or put any stock in them, but, you know, if I pick up a newspaper that has horoscopes, I'll read mine and read friends and, you know, loved ones and whatever. And after he died, I caught myself reading his horoscope. And then poets are always looking for points of insertion, and that struck me as a possible place to mine that idea. What if, you know, I mean, a lot of my poems are kind of what-if situations. So what if that did have horoscopes, or what if they don't?
right.
And then how would that play out? So
the book begins with a poem where the poet, the I voice, is addressing his mother and father on the foot of their grave, and that's actually pretty funny too, but kind of holds the book together, or sets the tone, I guess you could say.
Yeah, well, that's true. I have a poem in an earlier book where I'm driving past the cemetery where my parents are buried, and I'm in a rush to get somewhere. I don't have time to stop, so I just toot the horn. And then for the rest of the day, I imagine my father rising up, you know, to give me this familiar look of disapproval, while my mother, the last line of the poem is, while my mother calmly tells him to lie back down. So it's kind of it's kind of funny and grotesque at the same time.
Right. Do you walk a lot? Do you take walks in the city a lot? You live in New York City, right?
I live outside New York City and in Florida now. I love to walk. And I lost my dog a couple of years ago, and I'm interviewing for a replacement now. But, you know, among other delights that a dog provides is an excuse to a kind of a legitimate reason to walk. It sort of adds the wandering, meditative rhythm of walking. It gives it some kind of practical purpose. But yeah, I think Wordsworth was a great walker, and he composed while walking, and he felt that the pace of walking gave his composition some rhythm. So, and there's also a Latin expression, don't ask me to spell it, but I think it's solvitur ambulandi, and it means it is solved by walking.
Oh,
so
nice.
If you have a problem, take a walk and keep walking until the problem is at least somewhat clarified, which could result in just walking around the world, but if the problem is too big. But and you're supposed to turn around at some point on the way back to the house. You're supposed to feel a little less upset by the question.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of that poem, The Flaneur, in Horoscopes for the Dead. We're talking to Billy Collins, arguably one of the most, if not the most famous poet in America. The Flaneur is a very funny poem that kind of makes fun of poets and makes fun of this idea that poets walk. And the fact is, poets do seem to love to walk. Hart Crane walking across the Brooklyn Bridge, Borges walking through Buenos Aires. I mean, that whole idea of walking has been a very important part of poetry. But the poem, The Flaneur, is talking about how the flaneur, who is one who walks, one who strolls leisurely, walking around Paris through all those wonderful sights, but the poet, has to walk around Florida, searching for meaningful things and beautiful things to contemplate poetically, like a guy looking at his watch, which is the opportunity to think of time. It's very funny, yet at the same time, there's a lot of truth behind that. You could walk anywhere and find things to contemplate.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of seriocomic. You know, I think in a lot of these poems, I'm trying to pitch the poem on some very thin line between the serious and the comic, and I'm trying not to sort of fall in either direction. And there, I'm kind of making fun of the whole idea of the flaneur was always this very cosmopolitan character, also called like the boulevardier, you know, the guy who would just stroll down the boulevard, a kind of Dan who would be lost in his thoughts and making observation in his head about the city and life and so forth. And I thought I would just Americanize that and deflate it somewhat. But at the same time, the walker in Florida is making his own observations. He's making do. You know, it's not Paris, but it's somewhere.
Yeah, and I was talking to somebody about this poem the other day when we were, by the way, taking a walk through a park. And I was saying there's this line, or this image, I should say, because I didn't memorize the line. And I'd like to enter Billy Collins' poems the way Billy Collins instructs us to do an introduction to poetry, which I'll get to a little later. I like to enter into the poem and be on that walk and be in the suburbs. There's another wonderful poem you have about how noisy the suburbs is. But I was talking to this person. I was saying how funny it was when the skateboard, a guy on a skateboard flies by and the poet is thinking about the folly of youth. And the person that I was talking to didn't take it as humor, but they thought, that's so true. And they started going into that and going into that. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about the simplicity of your poetry. It seems very, very simple, yet at any point you could just go deeper and deeper into the landscape, turn on the lights, feel around, and take a walk along with them.
Well, I guess, I mean, just to put it that way, the folly of youth, it sounds very old-fashioned.
Exactly.
You know, it sounds like it's sort of an 18th century, a kind of a serious meditative subject. But when you throw in a skateboard, it becomes a little funny. But still, the youth is full of its own follies, no matter what century you're in.
We're talking to Billy Collins. His latest book is Horoscopes for the Dead, Poems. And probably one of the most famous poems in the English language today is Introduction to Poetry. And I know when I teach an Introduction to Creative Writing class, I usually introduce that poem within the first 2-3 weeks of the course. But the idea of the poem is that students, when they enter a poem, well, they don't so much enter a poem as tie it to a chair and try to beat meaning out of it. But the poem tries to tell them to enter into it, to go inside and feel around. I like that poem because I teach a lot of Kafka to brilliant students, and brilliant students and Kafka together are a bad combination because they're always trying to find the singular meaning or something. And I tell them, go in, feel around, look around, and I use that poem, and I say, turn on the lights, what's inside a Kafka landscape? And one of the things that we've discovered is when you go inside of a landscape of a famous poem or a famous story or just a very good story, you find, as you're looking around with a flashlight, other people looking around with a flashlight, like you might find Borges inside of a Kafka landscape. Who do you find inside of the poems that you read? Who do you often meet up with when you're entering a poem?
That's a very good way to put it. I often run into myself,
that's very Borgian.
Or as myself, like, disguised as Borges. especially if what we tend to do, I think, a lot is reread poems. I mean, I've revisited, as a kind of lifelong professor, I've read things like Tintern Abbey, just dozens and dozens of times, and I tend to run into my earlier self. I run into my, the self I was in graduate school, and these, because all these readings pile up,
right.
And you have a kind of history of your readings of the poem, and that's what makes, one of the things that makes teaching challenging, because if you're teaching a poem that you've read, 30 or 40 times and actually talked about that many times for half an hour or so, and then you're trying to get this across to 25 students who've never seen the poem before, it's almost as if you have an unfair advantage over them.
Right.
But I certainly agree that, I was trying in that little poem, the Introduction to Poetry, just to suggest that interpretation is only one approach to poetry, right. And there are other approaches which are less teachable, so they don't get into the classroom. The teacher, in the worst scenario, wants to stand between the student and the poem as an interpreter, as a religious figure would like to stand between you and God, so that I'd get to God except going through, Father Mahoney or something. So a lot of the rhythm of the poem, the colors of the poem, just the surface of the poem and the interior of the poem, as you say, can be explored with pleasure before anyone says one word about what the poem means.
And, like the walk I take to the studio, which is about a half an hour, and I usually, for some reason, choose the same path almost all the time, but every time I notice something different, and I, marvel at something different. It's the same way entering your poems. This time around, when I entered into this particular book, I ran into Szymborska a lot.
Well, she's been a great, I would say, I read her probably too late for her to be like a seminal influence, but she's been a great encourager of my work in that she, I was very honored to be asked to introduce one of her books. I think the book is called Monologue of a Dog that came out a few years ago, so I wrote the introduction to that.
That could have been a title of Billy Collins, Monologue of a Dog.
It certainly could have. Well, I think we're kindred, if I can say that, in that she uses very simple diction. These are all translations from the Polish. But I've talked to translators or talked to people who are Polish-speaking, and they say that the translations that I'm reading, usually by, I think, Claire Kavanaugh, are very faithful, that in the Polish she's also using very simple palette, very simple vocabulary, and yet she is achieving in these poems amazing imaginative leaps and jumps. And so it shows that you can use a very, very clear and modest vocabulary and yet take readers into some quite fantastic places.
With her poetry and your poetry, I have the same ability to just follow this very, very, what seems to be very simple, straightforward language, but suddenly I found myself in parallel worlds where absolutely anything can happen.
Yeah, well, it's also a path, and we should say her name again, right? Wisława Szymborska. She got the Nobel Prize in the late 90s. Not the Pulitzer, but the Nobel Prize for Literature, and was, prior to that, not well-known outside of Poland. And now she's become kind of required reading for young American poets. But her poems are always taking you somewhere.
Yeah.
And they start out very simply. There's a poem where she wants to thank her sister for not writing poetry. And the whole poem is about what a great relief it is to go over to her house because she's not going to have to listen to her poetry. So she's also, Szymborska is also very self-deprecating and I think very aware of the potential pomposity and taking oneself so seriously that poetry offers. Because often when, especially younger poets, me included, one sits down to write a poem, and one gets much more serious than one should, you know, about oneself.
You know, you said in an interview, this is a quote, you say, "I try to presume that no one is interested in me." How does that presumption help you write poetry?
Well, by excluding direct autobiographical narrative, I'm not conscious of writing at all about just stuff that happened to me, or my persona just didn't have much of a past.
Mm-hmm.
He has parents, we know that, but there's not much else you can say about him.
Right.
So it's my persona tries to be someone who's just present right there when the poem begins, and he's not dragging a kind of U-Haul trailer of misery and past afflictions and traumas and whatnot, or even just the usual sociological baggage into the poem. Emerson refers to a transparent eyeball, mm-hmm. and that's the sort of, I attempt to get a kind of clear-eyed perspective on things like that. I guess I assume that no one's interested in my past because I'm not really interested in anyone else's past to much of an extent. I mean, to be a poet, you don't really need to have a high interest in others. You have to have it, and it helps to be an only child.
Right.
But you have to have a keen interest in what's going through your own mind.
Right, you know, and also what it also seems to say to me, I try to presume that no one is interested in me, is it means that every poem has to be earned. There can't be this presumption that, you know, I'm a poet, therefore you should pay attention. It's rather every single poem has to somehow stand on its own and earn that interest.
Well, that's the other thing. You have to pleasure the reader. I mean, I presume the reader is not interested in me. The reader doesn't come to the poem because they have any interest in my internal life. They come to poetry because they love poetry. So, and I tell this to my students, that in every poem, you have to tell a little lie, an implicit lie. And the lie is that you love poetry more than you love yourself. And you, of course, you don't.
Right.
You know? But if the reader is coming to the poem for poetry's sake, and if you present a poem that shows that's what you're really interested in, then you have instant linkage. The both of you love poetry. And at that point, if you happen to be an autobiographical poet, the reader will be seduced by the form of your poem and will be interested in some kind of canoeing trip you took with your uncle or something.
When you say that, you know, your poems aren't necessarily autobiographical, for some reason I want that poem in Horoscopes for the Dead called Hell, which is a brilliant poem about walking through a super mattress store. For some reason, I want that to be true. Tell us about that, because, you know, if people haven't read that, it's just a brilliant, brilliant idea.
I don't know. There's just some, I don't think, it's hard to think of a more unpleasant experience that doesn't involve the infliction of physical pain than shopping for a mattress. I mean, it's just these cavernous stores with this harsh lighting and this salesman trying to determine whether you want firm or, you know, how much money. And then, of course, you have to lie down, especially if you're with your mate. You have to lie down these things and kind of bounce around on them while this guy is watching you. And I don't know, it's just excruciating.
Yeah, I love the description. Yet wandering past jovial kings and more sensible queens and the cheerless singles. That's beautiful. That's fantastic.
There is a kind of personified field there.
But you compare it to Dante's Inferno. I think sometimes I feel that way walking through Walmart. I kind of feel like I'm walking through some sort of hellish place. You were the United States Poet Laureate, and you said on your TED Talk, by the way, we're talking to Billy Collins, and you have that TED Talk. I love those TED Talks. I was very pleased to see your presentation where you show these videos that have been made based on your poems, these animations made on your poem. Tell us a little about how that must have felt, seeing your poem interpreted by somebody else through images.
I'm a great believer in poetry kind of getting off the shelves of the library and getting out of the professor's study and getting into real life, mm-hmm. and poetry on on billboards, and I started when I was poet laureate. I started a channel on Delta Airlines for poetry, so you could listen to poetry while you flew around.
Wow.
I thought that when they approached me, I was apprehensive because I thought turning a poem into a cartoon, it could just completely trivialize the poem, because I was thinking of like Dora the Explorer or something, or you know, Barbara. But these were very serious animators that I think were influenced by European animations of the 60s and 70s. And I got to vet them, too. I mean, I think there's some bootleg stuff. I mean, you can just go off and make a cartoon of anything. But the mm-hmm. ones that were done, they were done originally for the Sundance Channel. And I think shown maybe 10 of them, and I didn't like one of them. So they sent that back. But I liked all the others. And I thought it was great. I thought they were, you know, they were kind of obvious. I didn't find them interpreting as well as much as just illustrating.
Or unfolding. I love their, they kind of unfolded the poem imagistically.
Some people thought they were distractions. They would rather just listen to the poem. But,
Well, you know, you said something in the TED Talk that really struck me. You said that some people think that you can just put music to poetry, but you can't often put music to poetry because you have two rhythms fighting against each other, and it just doesn't.
Right.
It's like noise. But you know what they did, of course, was was much different. It kind of complemented the poem, I guess you can say.
Yeah, there wasn't too much. Some of them didn't have any music. I think most of them did. Yeah, I mean, people have set my poems to music, and I used to think that was fine, but I would always caution them by that the poems had already been set to music by me, in that I'm writing with my ear. You know, I'm trying to think musically as I'm writing. All poets want their poems to sound good. And so now at this point, there have been so many disastrous collisions of my poetry and music that I don't give permission for that to be done if I'm asked.
Absolutely. You know, when we had Philip Levine on the show, we asked him what he planned on doing as poet laureate, and he said as little as possible. It seems that you actually did something as poet laureate. That project 180 Poems, did that come out of your position as poet laureate? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that did. Well, the good thing about, just to step back a minute, I mean, the good thing about the laureateship in this country is that you can do as little or as much as
right,
you want.
Right.
It's very much up to you. And it just fits your personality and your energy and your ambitions. I might not have, like Phil Levine, I might not have done much either had I not felt some pressure from predecessors who came up with these very ambitious programs to spread poetry. So I came up with I picked 180 poems. I put them on a website. I encouraged teachers to read a poem every day, every poem for one day of the school year, every day of school year. And that's still up there. You can go to the Library of Congress website and link into Poetry 180. But more up to date are the two anthologies that my publisher did called Poetry 180 and 180 More, I think. They're just, instead of being for high schools now, these books are really just, I mean, not just, but they're kind of samplers of how poetry sounds today. And if anybody has been kind of driven away from poetry for any reason, but usually through teaching in high school or college, these anthologies are a good way just to catch up with what's been happening with poetry. And I tried to pick poems that are clear, accessible, imaginative, sometimes funny, sometimes not, but readable, very readable.
Right. Is it true that you grew up in the same town where William Carlos Williams practiced medicine?
No, but there's some truth to that. I was born in the French Hospital, which is, was there anymore, was on West 30th Street in Manhattan in New York City. And William Carlos Williams did practice there as a pediatrician, but before I was born. So he could have delivered me if the timing had been right, but I was born too late for that.
Yeah. I was hoping for some sort of kind of weird mystical connection, like maybe you might have walked by the very house that he was exiting when he saw the white chickens next to the barn.
he could have applied his forceps to my head, but that would have been the magic touch, maybe.
Or the forceps used by another doctor might have been held by him. Maybe there's a connection.
Well, there you go.
One of the things I really like about you as a poet is what you said in an interview. And I need to know right now if it's true. You said Bugs Bunny is my muse.
Well, yeah, I mean, the background was I was, as a kid, into Merry Melodies and Warner Brothers cartoons, right? And I didn't like Disney. I thought Disney was, all the characters.
Hokey.
They're hokey and they're like married. You know, like there's Mickey and Minnie and Donald and Daisy, and they're totally bourgeois.
Right.
And whereas there's no possibility of there being a Mrs. Daffy Duck. I mean, there's no duck or any creature that would marry. Daffy is unmarriageable. The Warner Brothers cartoons, Looney Tunes, Merry Melodies, where the characters are much more renegade. You know, I mean, Porky Pig's married, but that's okay. He's Porky Pig.
Yeah.
He needs to have a companion, but he's married and he looks it. I mean, that's why he stammers.
Right.
because of Petunia. But yeah, those cartoons, and I watch them, I still love them, and they, they show you a universe that's so malleable and such crazy things can happen. You can get run over by a steamroller and then just pop back into your regular body, and I think it's a great way to stretch the imagination of children. Mm-hmm. I mean, these days they probably are thought of as terribly old-fashioned with video games and whatnot, but back then they were... Left quite an impression.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Can we ask you if you'd be willing to read one of your poems from the new book?
I could. This is a poem from the new book, Horoscopes for the Dead, and it's titled Revision. When I finally pulled onto the shoulder of a long country road after driving a few hundred miles without stopping or even blinking, I sat there long enough to count 24 cows in a wide sloping pasture. Nothing about the scene asked to be changed, things being just what they were, and there was even a green hill looming solidly in the background. Still, I felt the urge to find a pencil and edit one of them out, that sway-backed one standing in the shade in a far corner of the field. I was too young then to see that she was staring into the great mystery just as intently as her sisters, her gorgeous brown and white philosophic sisters.
That was Billy Collins. Thank you, Billy, for being on Words on the Wire.
Very nice to talk to you. Thank you.